Hello and welcome to the menu, Monocle's food and drink program. I am Markus Hippi. This week, Palestinian author Reem Kassis on how much food unites the Arab world.
What I wanted to convey, and the reason that the book is actually split by ingredient, is the evolution of this cuisine from the earliest cookbooks on record to today. And ingredients were the easiest way to convey that story.
Then we are in Dubai, that is, trying to reinvent itself as a global hub for coffee culture.
If you're planning to try a coffee laced with gold, make sure someone else is picking up the check. And don't spill it in your lap.
We'll also look ahead to a new restaurant launch in Tokyo by British chef Daniel Calvert, hear a top dinner soundtrack recommendation and get an update on the week's food and drink headlines. That is all ahead on this edition of The Menu here on Monocle 24. Palestinian writer Reem Kassis released her debut cookbook, The Palestinian Table, in 2017 for much critical acclaim. Now Kassis is back with her second book, The Arabesque Table, Contemporary Recipes from the Arab World. The release takes a broader look at contemporary cooking across the Arab world, emphasizing how much different countries share and have influence on each other. I spoke to Kassis a bit earlier and she started by explaining why choosing the name for the book took longer than writing it.
I submitted my second manuscript draft without a title for the book. But in hindsight, this was actually a blessing more than anything because the name derived as a result of the experience of writing it and what I learned along the way. And the reason we chose the Arabesque table is Arabesque, as you might already know, is an intertwined pattern or design that is recognized in Islamic and Arabic art. And what I wanted to convey with the book was that cuisine, similar to this artistic pattern that inspired the title, is inherently also infinitely intertwined and more beautiful as a result. In addition to that, though, I mean, we were trying to get a name that conveyed what the food was, and to call it the Arab table would not necessarily have been accurate, because there were a lot of dishes inside that were inspired by other cuisines and the intersection of those cuisines. So Arabesque conveyed both of those things, you know, the intersection, at the same time, the idea that it is not purely one regional kind of cooking in the book.
Now, tell me more about the approach you took when you were working on this book. You say that you wanted to celebrate the evolution of Middle Eastern cuisine.
One thing I specified in the book is the whole idea of the term Middle East doesn't convey accurately the cuisine of our region. Because Middle East is simply a term for a region that was between the British Empire's easternmost colony of India and Europe. And what really ties the cuisine of our region together is its being Arab and its acculturation under Arab and Islamic rule. So the approach I took was, it started out actually, Markus, initially with my desire just to convey what a modern Arab table looked like. But having spoken to many people and seen what our day-to-day cuisine might be, I realized you really need to understand the history to make any sense of what we're eating today. So that's why I went back in history. I started, you know, with the first cookbooks on record, which happened to be Arab cookbooks from the 10th century. And in those books, you know, there are recipes which to try to replicate today would be impossible. So some of those I modernized and made easier to cook with. Other recipes I wrote as a result of inspiration from having eaten different kinds of cuisines, national cuisines, and thought about how those could potentially influence our cooking. And then others were simply the use of Arab ingredients to flavor dishes that might be more international or cosmopolitan, if you will, or more recognized. So it was an amalgamation of those three factors that led to the recipes you see in the book.
Now, tell me about this evolution of Middle Eastern cuisine. You say that you went through some very, very old cookbooks and you say that those recipes can't really be done today. What kind of stuff did you find from there and how much has changed over the past 1,000 years?
A lot has changed, Markus. I mean, forget 1,000 years. Just look at the last 200 years. Tomatoes did not make their way to the Arab world until the 19th century. They didn't make their way to Italy until the 18th. So if you look at many of the stews that you would find in those cookbooks, they were thickened with almond and soured with vinegar. So the very idea of tomato-based stews did not even exist. Rice also was something relegated to the upper echelons of society, and many of these cookbooks indeed were written in royal courts. But you see much heavier reliance on wheat grains and its ensuing products. you also see the use of ingredients like tail fat or almond oil, which today are not the most common fats that you would use in cooking. You see herbs and spices that are not as easily accessible. So all those things have to be tailored to make cooking the recipes in my book easier.
So when you were thinking about what kind of recipes to include in this book, what was your principle? You are originally from Jerusalem. When you were looking at what you want to tell the world about the food from the Arab world, what do you think were the essential contemporary recipes you wanted to showcase to the world?
So what I really wanted to show was how the foods we eat today don't necessarily fit into a specific mold. So they can be dishes that are inspired by other cuisines, by other ingredients. As you know, for many Arabs, whether by choice or circumstance, they're not always in their countries of origin. And the access to ingredients you have in other places impacts what you're able to cook. So what I wanted to convey, and the reason that the book is actually split by ingredient, is the evolution of this cuisine from the earliest cookbooks on record to today. And ingredients were the easiest way to convey that story. And that's why you see the book split up that way. And that was the story that I wanted to recount, which is much easier told by understanding how ingredients changed rather than specific recipes. And those dictated also what recipes made their way into each chapter.
What is your impression at the moment? How well do we understand the cuisine from the Middle East, from Arab countries? Is there much to be discovered still when you look at the global audience?
I think the cuisine is actually misunderstood, if we're being honest. You know, we say Middle East without really understanding, you know, it's a social science term without a very concrete definition. For some people, they'll say Middle Eastern food and they're including tagines, which are actually technically North African. But in terms of the dishes themselves, of course, there are always dishes left to be uncovered, but you also have the intersection of these dishes with other cultures. And that is, I guess, one of the things that this book tries to convey is I'm not here to give you a hummus recipe. I'm not here to give you, you know, a random salad just sprinkled with za'atar and calling it Arab. I'm trying to give you recipes that really trace the origin and show the potential for evolution down the line.
Is there something new you learned to understand when you were conducting this research to write this book?
So there's a lot of interesting things I learned along the way. Primary amongst those things was how influential Arab cuisine has been on the cuisine of the entire world. There are many dishes that we take for granted. You know, take panna cotta, for example, a very traditional Italian dessert. And if you dig further back, you realize it was the Arabs who introduced the very idea of thickening milk with a starch to Europe. If you look at tapas in Spain and the very idea of frying, you know, many tapas like croquetas and patatas bravas might be deep fried in oil. The idea of deep frying in oil was introduced to Spain by the Moors. Bagels, which are for now traced back to 16th century Poland, the first mention of a ring-shaped dough that is boiled before being baked is found in a 13th century Arabic cookbook. So I think for me, it was just fascinating to see how much of what we consume today can be traced back to such old Arab cookbooks and how much we don't know about this history.
Well, now, finally, I have to ask, since you've been mapping out the evolution of Arabic food, what do you expect from the future?
I expect to see a lot of dishes that just become an amalgamation of different cultures coming together or different ingredients based on availability. And for me, one important thing in writing this book was to show that as this process happens, it's very important to know this history so that it doesn't get lost. Because fusion is great. Fusion has been happening since the beginning of time with cuisine. But if we don't take the time to understand the origins and to document them, then all of that gets lost in the process. And then the new foods that we're coming up with are no longer as special or meaningful as they could be if we know where the different components and ideas are coming from.
Reem Kassis there. Her book, The Arabesque Table, Contemporary Recipes from the Arab World, is out now. Now, how far would you go to get a good cup of coffee? I mean, a really good cup of coffee. The city of Dubai in the United Arab Emirates is trying to position itself as a new global hub for coffee culture. But contributor Ruth Michelson was on the hunt for something more traditional than espresso to go. Traditional coffee normally served as part of social gatherings in the Gulf. And for good measure, there is a gold cappuccino too.
Like many people, I start my day with a coffee, and very often continue with several more cups of coffee. And right now, I'm in Dubai, a city where there's no shortage of international coffee chains and a growing number of single-origin coffee shops. There's also the more traditional cardamom-flavoured coffee served across the Gulf, something of a personal favourite. So I set out on a mission, a coffee quest, if you will. Where can I find the best cup of coffee in Dubai?
Here is your espresso.
Oh, thank you.
It's from Brazil.
So this is where we store our coffee beans. We're expanding in that front as well. And here you see different shelves that will stack the Brazil coffee, which is the majority because that's our best seller. We can't get it in fast enough. So Brazil is here. We've got beans from Ethiopia right here in the center. We've got beans over there at the top from Colombia, some from Rwanda over there. And over here, oh, El Salvador here.
I started my tour at Gold Box, a roastery and coffee shop tucked between warehouses just off the Sukim Road. Gold Box's Heba Haddad isn't exaggerating when she says the smell that draws you in is their calling card. They import beans from all over the world, roasting them to create single-origin coffees and sometimes exporting around the region. We started, as I'm happy to say, with a tasting.
Is when customers come in, we ask them what they're used to drinking because it really varies what your palate is used to as well. If you're used to drinking something more on the chocolatey notes, you're not a fan of the fruitiness, I wouldn't advise on the Ethiopia, for example. I would start you off with something more safe, let's say, or more popular, which is like the Brazil or another blend that we have, which is the dark sugars, which is really heavy in the chocolatey notes. And then if you're willing to take an adventure, let's say, I'll start you off with the Rocco Mountain, which is a mild fruitiness, and before going into the other ones, which are more extreme in fruitiness, like some of the Kenyans or the Rwandans, for example. So it really depends. If you do like your fruity coffee to begin with, then hands down, I would start you off with the Rocco Mountain and some of our other Ethiopians. Really lovely.
Yeah, this Ethiopian espresso, it feels like it's like dancing across my tongue.
Yeah. It's nice, isn't it? It's like every time you take a sip, you get different notes. And then when it cools down as well, there are different notes that become more apparent as well.
I just took a sip and it tastes a little almost licorice flavor somewhere in there.
Yeah, I mean, it's possible. In the end of the day, everyone's palate is different. What you pick up could be very different than what I pick up, than what Dong would pick up. So there's no right or wrong answer. As long as you enjoy the cup of coffee, that's all that matters.
Dubai has been part of global trade routes for tea and spices since the city was founded. But with growing coffee culture, the Emirate is increasingly trying to position itself as a centre for coffee exports too. Dubai already houses the Multi-Commodities Centre, a trade zone that accounts for 60% of the global tea trade, making it the world's largest single tea trader. But in 2019, the DMCC launched a coffee centre designed to attract companies to set up there in order to export coffee to the Middle East and beyond, including roasting machines and special climate-controlled storage. Dubai's coffee industry is growing. Figures from early last year show a trade worth almost $70 million.
So let's talk a little bit about Dubai coffee culture. Traditionally, when I've thought of coffee in the Gulf, you think about the coffee ceremony. You're sitting down, there's the big pot, everybody has a little cup, it takes a little bit of time, it's a very social occasion. But Dubai seems to be very much about espresso and takeaway coffee and moving fast and getting deals done, and the coffee is all part of that. How do these things intersect, and you know, how does Gold Box come into it?
So you're right. So Dubai, because it's such a fast-paced culture, everyone here's on steroids, right? They have to get things on the go, and which is why that culture of espresso, quick on-the-go takeaway is a big thing. However, because it's an Arab country, there's still that root of people socializing around coffee. Unfortunately, with the pandemic, that has affected that a little bit, but still you'll see people gathering in the evenings over a cup of coffee,
just socializing and me catching up with friends, really. So that culture is still there, more in the evening. Probably during the day, that's where you see the on-the-go espresso kind of thing. But in the evenings, when you pass by a lot of the cafes in Dubai or in the UAE, you'd see a lot of still Emirati people sitting around, ladies and men, sitting around just enjoying a cup of coffee for long hours and just catching up. So that's still there.
I've noticed that Dubai is now starting to try and be a big coffee exporter as well, and they've started a kind of exchange that suggests that they want to boost coffee exports from here specifically. So rather than just being an importer, they're looking at exporting. I'm interested in how Goldbox and your import of beans might fit into that. You know, do you think that Dubai is trying to sell itself as a kind of coffee capital, basically?
I think, yes, it is. Dubai always tries to be the first at everything, which likely so it has that potential to do that. And with a lot of roasteries setting up here, I mean, in the last year or in 2019 alone, I think there was four or five different roasters that set up here at the same time. So everyone's trying to get into that industry. And we are looking into that as well. We're looking at exporting. We are exporting at the moment. However, we see there will be a big demand in the future with exporting to places like Saudi, Egypt, the rest of the Middle East as well. That is also where the awareness of specialty coffee is growing. So we are looking into that in the next short term, for sure.
But Dubai's coffee culture is built on foundations of an entirely different kind, a much slower social interaction than your average takeaway espresso. Traditional coffee from the Arabian Gulf involves brewing very lightly roasted coffee beans, mixing the coffee with cardamom and spices, and pouring the coffee from a pot or dulla into tiny round cups, often served with dates. While espresso has taken off in Dubai, this kind of coffee is traditionally served after a meal or when people get together to talk. And personally speaking, hunting down the best Gulf coffee was why I started this coffee quest in the first place. So I travelled up to the top of Dubai, close to its historic port, to the relaxing environment of the Arabian Tea House. And there, Chef Mohammed Akesh walked me through how coffee is traditionally served in the Gulf.
It's Arabic coffee, we serve it in the pot, we'll not serve it in the cups. When we have a pot, when you have a guest, you will give it in left hand and make it like that, make it the high the pot, and we put little oil in the cups. If the guest need more, they will give you in his hand, we need more. If he don't want, they will say like that, like, I don't want. If they need more, they will move the cups, like right and left, like that. And we serve it with the fresh dates and with the sesame oil. This is the sesame oil.
This is tahina. This looks tahina. Delicious.
Yes.
First of all, I want to say this coffee is delicious.
Thank you.
Can you tell me about the flavors that are in this coffee?
In Gulf country, we have different of Arabic coffee. Like in Saudi Arabia, they add more cardamoms, less coffee. In Kuwait, they add some spices. Here in Dubai, most of the people, they like the coffee, less cardamom, with saffron, rose waters. You can add some spices sometimes if they like to add ginger powder. But here our standards will add the saffrons, cardamoms and rose waters.
And it turns out that the Arabian Tea House has even found a way to make traditional coffee as portable as espresso, all in aid of their special blend of coffee, cardamom, saffron and rose water.
Because some of the guests, you know, they are going from here to Abu Dhabi, they don't want to drink the espresso coffee. They will come here, they will buy the dalla with the Arabic coffee, stay for 2 hours.
Wait, so they're buying a dalla with coffee in, and then they're in their car and they can pour it on the way?
Yes, yes.
Does that happen a lot?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And some of the guests, they give me their dalla from the home and we make it here, the Arabic coffee. Because an Arabian tea house, really, we have a special Arabic coffee. They give me his boat, dalla, and they bring here. They say to me, I need 3 portion, 4 portion. When they have a party, when they go outside, when they go to bed for whole day, they bring the dalla and we make it here, 3 portion, 4 portion, we give it to them.
So, it turns out, in Dubai, even traditional coffee is portable if you know where to get it. Score 1 for Gulf coffee. And finally, this fact-finding mission would not be complete without sampling one of Dubai's most famous coffees, the signature drink of the Burj Al Arab, which claims to be the world's only 7-star hotel. From the luxurious cafe that serves this coffee inside the sail-shaped hotel, you can gaze out over the Persian Gulf. A Burj Al Arab cappuccino topped with flakes of 24-karat gold will set you back just over $32. I don't drink milk, so I roped in my partner Jared Malson to help me with this vital research and discover what a gold cappuccino tastes like.
We have a golden cappuccino, please.
Okay, thank you.
Between 3 carats of gold. And here we have a double espresso with gold and beef.
That is a gold espresso.
Exactly. And there's some small cookies for you.
Thank you. Okay, so firstly, tell me what we're looking at.
We are looking at a gold-encrusted cappuccino that sort of has this layer of gold flakes floating, suspended on the top of it.
And do those look like something that is, I don't know, edible or going to improve the taste of this cappuccino?
I'm going to find out. It certainly improves the appearance.
Get into it.
Okay, all right. Let's see, I'm going to pick up this cup very delicately. Take a sip. Oh my god, there's blue gold flakes everywhere.
That was a like, shower of gold
like
flakes.
Woody Allen in the cocaine scene in Annie Hall. Oh, it's delicious, actually.
Do you taste the gold? Is the gold improving
anything? You can't taste the gold. You can't taste it at all. I know. I have gold flakes encrusting my lap now also, so that's... I'm very expensive, as you can see.
Okay, I'm going to try this espresso with a single gold flake floating in the middle of it, which is an expensive-looking espresso. Tastes like espresso because I can't taste the gold flake. Oh, gold flake sort of sticking to my tongue, and then you just swallow it. That was a very expensive mouthful of coffee. Mm. Coffee's good.
The coffee is really good. Yeah, I don't know what the gold is adding other than the aesthetics, but why not? When in Dubai, drink gold things.
Is there a lesson in all of this? I'm not sure. Maybe it's that gold has no flavour. All I can say is, if you come to Dubai, there are lots of different types of coffee to try, and they're all worth your time. But perhaps, if you're planning to try a coffee laced with gold, make sure someone else is picking up the check. And don't spill it in your lap. For Monocle in Dubai, I'm Ruth Michelson.
Thanks, Ruth. You are listening to The Menu on Monocle 24. Let's next continue with this week's food and drink headlines. Here is Monocle's Maile Evans.
Thanks, Marcus. First, let's begin in Sydney, where this week a zero-waste bar project opened its doors. Rebar, spearheaded by cocktail maestro Matt Wiley, has set itself the ambitious task of ensuring that nothing, from the food to the drink to the decor, will go to waste. You can expect bench tops made with recycled milk bottles, banquettes clothed in pineapple leaf fibre, and a food menu full of creative off-cut uses. As for the drinks, there will be banana skin syrups and even leftover mushrooms featuring in the cocktails. Next to Perthshire in Scotland, where the country's oldest working whiskey distillery is diversifying into the restaurant industry. Glenturret will be opening what will be the first ever fine dining restaurant at a Scotch distillery, with Michelin-starred ex-Noma chef Mark Donald taking the helm. The restaurant, which is set to open later this year, will boast a menu packed with local Scottish ingredients. And finally to Tokyo, where famed Peruvian chef Virgilio Martinez has confirmed that his new fine dining restaurant MAS will open this summer. Martinez is known for his championing of indigenous Peruvian produce, and this will feature heavily in the new restaurant, as the menu has been designed to help diners connect with nature in the same way that Peruvian villagers and farmers do. That's all for this week. Back to you, Marcus.
Thanks, Maile. You are listening to The Menu on Monocle 24. Before today's dinner soundtrack recommendation, we meet one more guest. Daniel Calvert is a British chef who, after working in Paris, New York and Hong Kong, is getting ready to launch a brand new restaurant in Tokyo. Suzanne at Four Seasons Hotel Tokyo at Marunouchi is due to open in June. I spoke to Daniel to hear more about the new opening, his career and why it's important for top chefs to see the world.
You know, I recently came from another restaurant in Hong Kong where we had great success, and I'd like to continue the work we've been doing there by really accentuating the classic French flavor profiles, but doing them in a way maybe you don't expect, and staying true to our roots, but just try to lighten up the cuisine and make it applicable to today's diner.
Can you tell us more about that? What does that mean in practice?
What we were very good at in Hong Kong was localizing and really finding techniques or products from the region and really incorporating them into our cuisine, and not so much in a fusion way, but more of in a respectful way. And, you know, one of our dishes was what was called a drunken pigeon, but instead of poaching it in Shaoxing wine, we poached it in yellow wine from Jura and made a decidedly French dish out of it rather than something that was more Shanghainese. But just try to be respectful to the origin of the dish in itself.
What's interesting is that you have been working around the world. You've worked, for example, in New York, Paris, and as you mentioned already, in Hong Kong. What kind of a background is that for launching something new in Japan? Do you feel like you know what people want, or do you think there are some lessons you've learned before that may not work in Japan?
I think a bit of both, Marcus, because I'm English, I'm not French, so I cook French food from an outsider's perspective anyway. You know, I didn't grow up surrounded and immersed in the culture and the cuisine. So I think that gives you a certain amount of leeway and interpretation into what you want to do. You know, I think a lot of English chefs have the ability not to be typecast into a true French cuisine, but an interpretation of it. And I think that working in London has afforded me that, but then also cooking French food in New York also afforded me that. And then cooking French food actually in France was a bit of a verification, I would say. And then cooking French food in Hong Kong, it just opens your eyes and makes you able to adapt and apply different rules and different techniques to what is normally standard. And I think you become a little more open-minded from it.
As I mentioned already, you've worked in a number of top restaurants around the world. Why do you think it's important for chefs to see the world?
I started traveling because I didn't want to work in London anymore, to be honest. So that's where it started for me. But I think travel makes you a better person and produces better food. I think there's many dishes that I have executed in my time now as a chef that I'm extremely proud of that would not have been possible had I not lived in a certain country at a certain time or come across a certain person that introduced me to a certain dumpling spot or something, you know. And I think that you can find inspiration everywhere. And I think that if you don't travel and open yourself up, then, I mean, how much can you really see?
Very true. I know we've got quite a few listeners who are taking the first steps of their careers in hospitality. I'm wondering, what kind of tips can you give them how to become successful like you? You mentioned already that one of the reasons you decided to leave the UK was that you didn't want to work in London anymore.
I mean, I don't want to give tips on success because I think, as far as I'm concerned, I've still got a long way to go. But I would tell you the values that I still hold dear to me, and I think that are helping achieve success. And I think that relationship is really underappreciated and undervalued, the power of a relationship. And I think that for me, opening this restaurant in Tokyo, the power of relationship has been more apparent more than ever. And I've had many people that I've worked with in the past that I've called upon to come support us out here, and they've flown to Tokyo. You know, there's certain producers that I've worked with before, and I've expressed interest in working within Tokyo, and they've moved, you know, heaven and earth to get themselves import license into Japan just to supply us. And I think that you never know, not when you're going to need someone, but you never know when your paths are going to cross with someone again. And I think that you should always try to build great relationships and really nurture them. And I think that prime example in Hong Kong, I used to buy chickens off this one guy for 3 years or so. And he would produce all my chickens for me. He would do my sauce recipe, cut the chicken exactly the same size that I wanted every single day. And then had another guy come up to me and say, hey, I can do the same thing, but cheaper, and my chicken is better. He was 100% correct. His chickens were better and they were cheaper. But I was never going to change my relationship with this guy I've had for 3 to 4 years already just because of some other guy who could promise the world. And I think that a lot of people see these relationships as fair weather friends. And I think that if you're in this industry for a long haul, you should really invest in that. That is the biggest investment you can make.
Daniel, before I let you go, I would ask you to look into your crystal ball. I know that you've been stuck in Hong Kong and Tokyo for the last 12 months, and the last year certainly hasn't been easy for the hospitality sector. What do you think the longer term impact of the pandemic is going to be when you look at your industry? What will that world look like when places finally open up?
I think that I would say you're going to be looking at a realignment of values and what is really, truly important to the guest and the restaurant and the house and the chef. There's probably a lot of things that people were doing and they're all of a sudden thinking, well, why were we doing that? It could be anything down to reservation policies. It could be down to, you know, cooks coming into the industry. You know, there's a lot of unfortunate restaurant closures, which I think everyone would agree that became too many restaurants at one point and there weren't enough cooks to go around. So it became a renter's market, you know. I think that with the closure of some restaurants and the concentration of our industry, it will in turn produce a better cook again, I think.
Daniel Calvert there and his new restaurant, Cezanne, will open at Four Seasons Hotel Tokyo at Marunouchi in June. And that's all for this edition of The Menu. For previous episodes of this program, go to Monaco's website, SoundCloud or Apple Podcasts. And remember to subscribe to the show so that it automatically arrives onto your device every week. Also, do check out our Menu spin-off show, Food Neighbourhoods, for great recipes. This show was edited and mixed by David Stevens, and I am Markus Hippi. Once again, we finish this program with a dinner soundtrack recommendation. Here is The Swiss with In the City. Thanks for listening.